noises returned. The cars passing. Some distant voices. The hens beating their wings. Some minutes passed, and it was Stefano who began speaking again, but so softly that we couldn't hear what he was saying. I realized, though, that he was looking for a way to calm down. Short, disconnected phrases. Show me that you're done. Be good. Stop it. Leela's confession must have seemed so unbearable that he had ended by taking it as a lie. He had seen in it something she resorted to in order to hurt him, an exaggeration equivalent to a solid punch to bring his feet back to the ground. Words that in short meant, if you still don't realize what groundless things you're accusing me of, now I'm going to make it clear to you. You just listen. But to me, Leela's words seemed as terrible as Stefano's blows. I felt that if the excessive violence he repressed behind his polite manners and his meek face terrified me, I now couldn't bear her courage. That audacious impudence that allowed her to cry out the truth as if it were a lie. Every single word that she had addressed to Stefano had returned him to his senses, because he considered it a lie, but had pierced me painfully, because I knew the truth. When the voice of the grocer reached us more clearly, both Nunzia and I felt that the worst had passed. Don Achille was withdrawing from his son and returning him to his gentle, pliable side. And Stefano, restored to the part of himself that had made him a successful shopkeeper, was bewildered. He didn't understand what had happened to his voice, his hands, his arms. Even though the image of Leela and Nino holding hands probably persisted in his mind, what Leela had evoked for him with that hail of words could not help but have the flashing features of unreality. The door didn't open. The key didn't turn in the lock until it was day. But Stefano's voice became sad, a depressed pleading, and Nunzia and I waited outside for hours, keeping each other company with despondent, barely heard remarks. Whispered words inside, whispered words outside. If I tell Reno, Nunzia murmured, he'll kill him. Surely he'll kill him. And I whispered, as if I believed her, please don't tell him. But meanwhile, I thought, Reno, and even Fernando, after the wedding, never moved a finger for Leela. Not to mention that ever since she was born, they've hit her whenever they wanted. And then I said to myself, men are all made of the same clay. Only Nino is different. And I sighed, while my resentment grew stronger. Now, it's absolutely clear that Leela will have him, even if she's married. And together they'll get out of this filth, while I will be here forever. 76. At the first light of dawn, Stefano came out of his bedroom. Leela didn't. He said, pack your bags, we're leaving. Nunzia couldn't contain herself, and bitterly pointed out the damage he had done to the landlady's things, saying that he would have to compensate her. He answered, as if many of the words she had shouted at him hours earlier had stayed in his mind and he felt the need to dot the I's, that he always paid and would continue to pay. I paid for this house, he enumerated in a tired voice. I paid for your vacation. Everything you, your husband, your son have, I've given you. So don't be a pain in the neck. Pack the bags and let's go. Nunzia didn't say another word. A little later, Leela came out of the room in a yellow dress with long sleeves and big dark glasses, like a movie star. She didn't say a word to us. She didn't at the port, or on the boat, or even when we reached the neighborhood. She went home with her husband without saying goodbye. As for me, I decided that from that moment on, I would live for myself only. And as soon as we returned to Naples, that was what I did. I imposed on myself an attitude of absolute detachment. I didn't look for Leela. I didn't look for Nino. I accepted without argument the scene that my mother made, as she accused me of having gone to play the lady on Ischia, without thinking about how we needed money at home. Even my father, although he praised my healthy appearance, the golden blonde of my hair, did the same. As soon as my mother attacked me in his presence, he backed her up.
"You're a grown-up," he said. "You see what you have to do."
Earning money was, in fact, an urgent necessity. I could have demanded from Leela what she had promised me in compensation for my coming to Ischia. But after that decision to cut myself off from her, and especially after the brutal words that Stefano had addressed to Nunzia, and in some way also to me, I didn't do it. For the same reason, I absolutely ruled out the idea of her buying my school books, as she had the year before. When I saw Alfonso, I asked him to tell her that I had already taken care of the books, and closed the discussion. But after the August holiday, I presented myself again at the bookstore in Mezzocanone. And partly because I had been an efficient and disciplined sales clerk, partly because of my looks, which had been improved by the sun and the sea, the owner, after some resistance, gave me back my job. He insisted, however, that I should not quit when school started, but continue to work, if only in the afternoons, for the entire period of school book sales. I agreed, and spent long hours in the bookstore greeting teachers who came with bags full of books they had received free from publishing houses, to sell for a few lire, and students who sold their tattered used books for even less. I lived through a week of pure anguish when my period didn't come. Afraid that Sadatore had made me pregnant, I was in despair. I was polite on the outside, grim inside. I slept sleepless nights, but didn't ask advice or comfort from anyone. I kept it all to myself. Finally, one afternoon in the bookstore, I went to the dirty toilet and found the blood. It was one of the rare moments of well-being during that time. My period seemed a sort of symbolic cancellation of Sadatore's incursion into my body. In early September, it occurred to me that Nino must have returned from Ischia, and I began to fear and hope that he would come by at least to say hello. But he didn't show up on Via Mezzocanone, or in the neighborhood. As for Leela, I saw her only a couple of times, on Sunday, when, beside her husband in the car, she drove by on the Stradone. These few seconds were enough to enrage me. What had happened? How she had arranged things for herself. She continued to have everything, to keep everything. The car, Stefano, the house with the bathroom and the telephone and the television, the nice clothes, the prosperity. And who could say what plans she was devising in the secrecy of her mind? I knew how she was made, and I said to myself that she wouldn't give up Nino, even if Nino gave up her. But I chased away those thoughts and forced myself to respect the pact I had made with myself, to plan my life without them and learn not to suffer for it. To that end, I concentrated on training myself to react little or not at all. I learned to reduce my emotions to the minimum. If the owner reached out his hands, I repulsed him without indignation. If the customers were rude, I made the best of it. Even with my mother, I managed to stay submissive. I said to myself every day, I am what I am, and I have to accept myself. I was born like this, in this city, with this dialect, without money. I will give what I can give. I will take what I can take. I will endure what has to be endured. 77. Then school began again. Only when I entered the classroom on the 1st of October did I realize that I was in my last year of high school, that I was 18 years old, that the years of school, in my case already miraculously long, were about to end. So much the better. Alfonso and I talked a lot about what we would do after we graduated. He knew as much as I did. We'll take a civil service exam, he said. But in fact, we didn't have clear ideas on what the exams entailed. We said, sit the exam, pass the exam. But the concept was vague. Did you have to do a written exercise? Take an oral test? And what did you get once you'd taken it? A salary? Alfonso confided that he was thinking of getting married once he had taken the exam and gained a post. To Marisa? Yes, of course. Sometimes I asked him warily about Nino, but he didn't like Nino. They didn't even say hello to each other. He had never understood what I found in him. He's ugly, he said, all out of proportion, skin and bone. Marisa, on the other hand, seemed pretty to him, but he immediately added, careful not to wound me, you're pretty too. He liked beauty, and especially appreciated care for one's body. He himself was attentive to his appearance. He smelled of the barber. He bought clothes. He lifted weights every day. He told me that he had a good time at the shop in Piazza dei Martiri. It wasn't like the grocery. There you could be elegant. In fact, you had to be. There you could speak Italian. The people were respectable, had gone to school. There, even when you were on your knees in front of the customers, men and women, trying on the shoes, you could do it with pleasant manners, like the knight in a courtly love story. But unfortunately, he wouldn't be able to stay in the shop. Why? Well, at first he was vague, and I didn't insist. Then he told me that Pinuccia was staying home now because she didn't want to get tired. She had a belly like a torpedo. And anyway, it was clear that once she had the baby, she wouldn't have time to work. This, in theory, should have cleared a path for him. The Salatas were pleased with him. Maybe he would be able to establish himself there after he graduated. But it wasn't possible. And here, suddenly, the name of Lila came up. Just hearing it, my stomach flared up. What does she have to do with it? I knew she had returned from the vacation like a madwoman. She still wasn't pregnant. The swimming had been of no use. She was behaving oddly. Once, she had broken all the flower pots on her balcony. She said she was going to the grocery. Instead, she left Carmen alone and went walking around. Stefano woke up at night, and she wasn't in bed. She was wandering through the house. She read and wrote. Then suddenly she calmed down. Or rather, she focused her entire capacity to spoil Stefano's life on a single objective. For Giliola to work in the new grocery store, and she in Piazza dei Martiri. I was amazed. It's Michele who wants her in the shop, I said. But she doesn't want to go. Once. Now she's changed her mind. She's moving heaven and earth to get herself there. The only obstacle is Stefano. He's against it. But of course, in the end, my brother does what she wants. I asked no other questions. I wanted in no way to be reabsorbed into Lila's affairs. But for a while I surprised myself by wondering,
What could she have in mind? Why, all of a sudden, does she want to go and work in the city? Then I forgot about it, taken up by other problems. The bookstore, school, the class interrogations, the textbooks. Some I bought. Most I stole from the bookstore without too many scruples. I began studying rigorously again, mainly at night. In the afternoon, in fact, until Christmas vacation, when I quit, I was busy at the bookstore. And right after that, Professor Galliani herself arranged a couple of private pupils for me, and I worked hard for them. Between school, lessons, and study, there was no room for anything else. When, at the end of the month, I gave my mother the money I earned, she put it in her pocket without saying anything. But in the morning, she got up early to make breakfast for me, sometimes even a beaten egg, which she devoted such care to. While I was still in bed, half asleep, I heard the clack-clack of the spoon against the cup as she beat in the sugar. That it melted in my mouth like a cream, the sugar completely dissolved. As for the teachers at school, it seemed that they couldn't help considering me a brilliant student, as if the sluggish operation of the entire dusty scholastic machine had decided it. I had no trouble defending my position as first in the class, and, with Nino gone, I ranked among the best in the whole school. But I soon realized that although Professor Galliani continued to be very generous, she blamed me for some offense that kept her from being as friendly as she had been in the past. For example, when I gave her back her books, she was annoyed because they were sandy, and took them away without promising to give me others. For example, she no longer offered me her newspapers, and for a while I forced myself to buy Il Mattino. Then I stopped. It bored me. It was a waste of money. For example, she never invited me to her house, although I would have liked to see her son Armando again. Yet she continued to praise me publicly, to give me high grades, to advise me about important lectures, and even films that were shown in a parish hall in Portalba. Until once, near Christmas vacation, she called as school was letting out, and we walked some way together. Bluntly, she asked what I knew about Nino. "Nothing," I said. "Tell me the truth." "It's the truth." It slowly emerged that Nino, after the summer, had not been in touch either with her or with her daughter. "He broke up with Nadia in a very unpleasant way," she said, with the resentment of a mother. "He sent her a few lines in a letter from Ischia and caused her a lot of suffering." Then she contained herself and added, resuming her role as a professor again, "Never mind. You're all young. Suffering helps one grow." I nodded yes. She asked me, "Did he leave you too?" I turned red. "Me? Didn't you see each other on Ischia?" "Yes, but there was nothing between us." "Really?" "Absolutely." "Nadia is convinced that he left her for you." I denied it forcefully. I said I would be happy to see Nadia and tell her that between me and Nino, there had never been anything and never would be. She was pleased. She assured me that she would report it. I didn't mention Leela, naturally, and not only because I had decided to mind my own business, but also because to talk about it would have depressed me. I tried to change the subject, but she returned to Nino. She said that various rumors were circulating about him. There were some who said that not only had he not taken his exams in the autumn, but he had stopped studying. And there were some who swore that they had seen him one afternoon on Via Arenaccia, alone, completely drunk, lurching along, and every so often taking a swig from a bottle. But not everyone, she concluded, found him likable.
and maybe there were people who enjoyed spreading nasty rumors about him. If, however, they were true, what a pity. Surely they're lies, I said. Let's hope so. But it's hard to keep up with that boy. Yes. He's very smart. Yes. If you have a way of finding out what's happening, let me know. We parted. I hurried off to give a Greek lesson to a girl in middle school who lived in Parco Margarita. But it was difficult. The large, permanently semi-dark room where I was greeted respectfully held heavy furniture, rugs with hunting scenes, old photographs of high-ranking soldiers, and various other signs of a long history of authority and ease that produced in my pale 14-year-old pupil a dullness of body and intelligence, and in me a feeling of impatience. That day, I had to struggle to supervise declensions and conjugations. The picture of Nino as Professor Gallioni had evoked him kept returning to my mind. Worn jacket, tie flying, long legs staggering. The empty bottle that, after the last swallow, shattered on the stones of Via Arenaccia. What had happened between him and Leela after Ischia? Contrary to my predictions, she had evidently seen her mistake. It was all over. She had returned to herself. Nino hadn't. From a studious youth with a well-formulated response to everything, he had become a vagrant, undone by the pain of love for the grocer's wife. I thought of asking Alfonso again if he had news. I thought of going to Marisa myself and asking her about her brother. But soon I forced the idea out of my mind. It will pass, I said to myself. Has he come to see me? No. Has Leela come to see me? No. Why should I worry about him or her when they don't care about me? I continued the lesson and went on my way. 78. After Christmas, I found out from Alfonso that Pinucha had given birth. She had had a boy named Fernando. I went to see her, thinking that I would find her in bed, happy, with the baby at her breast. Instead, she was up, but in nightgown and slippers, sulking. She rudely sent away her mother, who said to her, "Get in bed. Don't tire yourself." And when she led me to the cradle, she said grimly, "Nothing ever works out for me. Look how ugly he is. It upsets me just to look at him, let alone touch him." And although Maria, standing in the doorway, murmured, like a soothing formula, "What are you talking about, Pina? He's beautiful." She continued to repeat angrily, "He's ugly. He's uglier than Reno. That whole family is ugly." Then she drew in her breath and exclaimed desperately, with tears in her eyes, "It's my fault. I made a bad choice of a husband, but when you're a girl, you don't think about it. And now look at what a child I've had. He has a pug nose, just like Leela." Then, with no interruption, she began to insult her sister-in-law grossly. I learned from her that Leela, the whore, had already in 2 weeks done and redone as she liked the shop in Piazza dei Martiri. Giliola had had to give in. She had returned to the Salata's pastry shop. She herself, Pinucha, had had to give in, chained to the child until goodness knows when. They had all had to give in, Stefano above all, as usual. And now, every day, Leela was up to something new. She went to work dressed up as if she were Mike Bongiorno's assistant. As if her husband wouldn't take her in the car, she had no scruples about getting Michele to drive her. She had spent who knows how much for two paintings that you couldn't understand what they were of, and had hung them in the shop for who knows what purpose. She had bought a lot of books, and instead of shoes, she put those on the shelf. She had fitted out a sort of living room, with couches, chairs, ottomans, and a crystal bowl where she kept chocolates from Guy Audin, available to whoever wanted them, free, as if she were there not to notice the stink of the customer's feet, but to play the great lady in her castle. "And it's not only that," she said. "There's something even worse."
"What? You know what Marcello Salata did?"
"No. You remember the shoes that Stefano and Reno gave him?"
"The ones made exactly the way Lena designed them?"
"Yes, a wretched shoe. Reno always said that the water got in."
"Well, what happened?"
Pina overwhelmed me with a laborious, sometimes confused story involving money, treacherous plots, deception, debts. Marcello, dissatisfied with the new models made by Reno and Fernando, and certainly in agreement with Michele, had had shoes like those manufactured, but not in the Cerullo factory, in another factory, in Afragola. Then, at Christmas, he had distributed them under the Salata name in the stores, including the one on Piazza dei Martiri.
"And he could do that?"
"Of course. They're his. My brother and my husband, those two shits, gave them to him. He can do what he likes."
"So?"
"So," she said, "now there are Cerullo shoes and Salata shoes circulating in Naples. And the Salata shoes are selling really well, better than the Cerullos. And all the profit is the Salatas. So Reno is extremely upset, because he expected some competition, of course, but not from the Salatas themselves, his partners, and with a shoe he made with his own hands and then stupidly threw away."
I remembered Marcello when Lila threatened him with the shoemaker's knife. He was slower than Michele, more timid. What need had he to be so offensive?
The Salatas had numerous businesses, some legitimate, others not, and they were getting bigger every day. They had had powerful friendships since the days of their grandfather. They did favors and received them. Their mother was a loan shark and had a book that struck fear into half the neighborhood. Maybe now the Cerullos and the Caraccis, too. For Marcello, then, and for his brother, the shoes and the shop on Piazza dei Martiri were only one of the many wells into which their family dipped, and surely not among the most important. So why? Panucci's story began to disturb me. Behind the appearance of money, I felt something depressing. Marcello's love for Lila was over, but the wound had remained and become infected. No longer dependent, he felt free to hurt those who had humiliated him in the past. "Reno," Pinuccia in fact said, "went with Stefano to protest, but it was pointless." The Salatas had treated them contemptuously. They were people used to doing what they wanted. Her brother and husband might as well have been talking to themselves. Finally, Marcello had said vaguely that he and his brother were thinking of an entire Salata line that would repeat, with variations, the features of the shoe that had been made as a trial. And then he added, without a clear connection, "Let's see how your new products go, and if it's worth the trouble to keep them on the market." Understood? Understood. Marcello wanted to eliminate the Cerullo brand, replace it with Salata, and thus cause not insignificant economic damage to Stefano. "I have to get out of the neighborhood. Out of Naples," I said to myself. "What do I care about their quarrels?" But in the meantime, I asked, "And Lena?" Pinuccia's eyes blazed. "She's the real problem." Lena had laughed at that story. When Reno and her husband got angry, she made fun of them. "You gave them those shoes, not me. You did business with the Salatas, not me. If you two are idiots, what can I do?" She wouldn't cooperate. You couldn't tell where she stood, with the family, or with the Saladas. So when Michele again insisted that he wanted her in Piazza dei Martiri, she had suddenly said yes, and had tormented Stefano to let her go. And why in the world did Stefano give in? I asked. Pinuccia let out a long sigh of impatience. Stefano had given in because he hoped that Lila, seeing that Michele valued her so much, and seeing that Marcello had always had a weakness for her, would manage to settle things. But Rino didn't trust his sister. He was frightened. He couldn't sleep at night. He liked the old shoe that he and Fernando had thrown away, and that Marcello had had made in its original form. It sold well. What would happen if the Saladas began to deal with Lila directly, and if she, a bitch since the day she was born, after refusing to design new shoes for the family, went on to design shoes for them? It won't happen, I said to Pinuccia. Did she tell you? No, I haven't seen her since the summer. So? I know what she's like. Lina gets curious about a thing, and she's utterly caught up in it. But once she's done it, the desire goes away. She doesn't care about it anymore. You're sure? Yes. Maria was content with those words of mine. She clung to them to soothe her daughter. You hear? She said. Everything is fine. Lenutra knows what she's talking about. But in fact, I knew nothing. The less pedantic part of me was well aware of Leela's unpredictability, so I couldn't wait to get out of that house. What do I have to do with it, I thought, with these wretched stories, with the petty vendetta of Marcello Salada, with this struggle and worry over money, cars, houses, furniture, and knickknacks and vacations? And how could Lila, after Ischia, after Nino, go back to jousting with those thugs? I'll get my diploma. I'll take the entrance exams. I'll win. I'll get out of this muck, go as far away as possible. I said, softening toward the baby, who Maria was now holding in her arms. How cute he is. 79. But I couldn't resist. I put it off for a long time, and finally I gave in. I asked Alfonso if one Sunday we could go for a walk, he and Marisa and I. Alfonso was pleased. We went to a pizzeria on Via Foria. I asked about Lydia, the children, especially Ciro. And then I asked what Nino was up to. She answered reluctantly, talking about her brother upset her. She said that he had gone through a long period of madness, and her father, whom she adored, had had a difficult time with him. Nino had gone so far as to lay hands on him. What the cause of the madness was, they never found out. He didn't want to study anymore. He wanted to leave Italy. Then suddenly it was over. He returned to himself and had just begun to take his exams. So he's all right? Who knows? He's happy. As far as somebody like him is capable of being happy, yes. And all he does is study? You mean, does he have a girlfriend? No, of course not. I mean, does he go out? Does he have fun? Does he go dancing? How should I know, Lenu? He's always out. Now he's obsessed with movies, novels, art. And the rare times he comes by the house, he starts arguing with Papa, just to insult him and quarrel with us. I felt relieved that Nino had come to his senses, but I was also bitter. Movies? Novels? Art? How quickly people changed with their interests, their feelings. Well-made phrases replaced by well-made phrases. Time is a flow of words coherent only in appearance. The one who piles up the most is the one who wins. I felt stupid. I had neglected the things I liked to conform to what Nino liked. Yes. Yes, resign yourself to what you are, each on his own path. I only hoped that Marisa would not tell him that she had seen me and that I had asked about him. Not even to Alfonso, after that evening, did I mention Nino or Lila. I withdrew even more into my duties. I multiplied them in order to cram my days and nights. That year I studied obsessively, punctiliously, and I even took on a new private lesson for a lot of money. I imposed on myself an iron discipline, much harsher than what I had enforced since childhood. A marking of time, a straight line that went from dawn until late at night. In the past, there had been Lila, a continuous happy detour into surprising lands. Now, everything I was, I wanted to get from myself. I was almost 19. I would never again depend on someone, and I would never again miss someone. The last year of high school slipped by like a single day. I struggled with astronomical geography, with geometry, with trigonometry. It was a sort of race to know everything, when in fact I took it for granted that my inadequacy was constitutional and so couldn't be eliminated. Yet I liked to do my best. I didn't have time to go to the movies. I learned titles and plots. Hadn't been to the archaeological museum. I ran through it in half a day. Hadn't been to the picture gallery of Capodimonte. I made a flying visit, 2 hours and done. I had too much to do, in short. What did I care about shoes and the shop on Piazza dei Martiri? I never went there. Sometimes I met Pinuccia, disheveled-looking, as she pushed Fernando in his carriage. I stopped a moment, listened absent-mindedly to her complaints about Rino, Stefano, Lila, Giliola, everyone. Sometimes I ran into Carmen, who was increasingly bitter about how badly things had been going in the new grocery since Lila left, abandoning her to the oppression of Maria and Pinuccia. And I let her vent for a few minutes about how she missed Enzo Scano, how she counted the days as she waited for him to finish his military service, how her brother Pasquale slaved between his construction work and his communist activities. Sometimes I ran into Ada, who had begun to hate Lila, while she was very pleased with Stefano and spoke of him tenderly. And not only because he had recently increased her salary, but also because he was a hard worker, available to everyone, and didn't deserve that wife who treated him like dirt. It was she who told me that Antonio had been discharged early because of a severe nervous breakdown. What happened? You know what he's like. He already had a breakdown with you. It was a mean statement that wounded me. I tried not to think about it. One Sunday in winter, I ran into Antonio and scarcely recognized him. He was so thin. I smiled at him, expecting him to stop, but he seemed not to notice me and kept going. I called him. He turned with a disoriented smile. Hello, Lenu.
Hello. I'm so glad to see you.
Me too.
What are you doing?
Nothing.
You're not going back to the workshop?
There's no job.
You're good. You'll find something somewhere else.
No. If I don't get better, I can't work.
What's wrong with you?
Fear.
He said it just like that. Fear.
In Cordonnance one night, while he was on guard duty, he had remembered a game that his father played when he was still alive, and he himself was very small. With a pen, his father would draw eyes and mouths on the 5 fingers of his left hand, and then he would move them and make them talk as if they were people. It was such a sweet game that, as he remembered it, tears came to his eyes.
But that night, during his shift, he had had the impression that his father's hand had entered his, and that now he had real people inside his fingers, tiny but fully formed, who were laughing and singing. That was the source of the fear. He banged his head against the sentry box until it bled, but the fingers went on laughing and singing without stopping, not for an instant. He recovered only when his shift was over and he went to sleep. A little rest, and the next morning it was gone. But the terror that the illness in his hand would return remained. In fact, it did return, and with increasing frequency, his fingers began to laugh and sing even in the daytime, until he had gone mad and they had sent him to the doctor. "It's gone now," he said, "but it could always start again."
"Tell me how I can help you."
He thought for a while, as if he were really evaluating a series of possibilities. He muttered, "No one can help me." I immediately understood that he no longer felt anything for me. I had definitively gone out of his mind. So after that encounter, I got in the habit of going every Sunday to his windows and calling. We would take a walk around the courtyard, talking about this and that. And when he said he was tired, we said goodbye. Sometimes Melina came down with him, garishly made up, and he and his mother and I walked. Sometimes we met Ada and Pasquale and took a longer walk. But then it was generally the three of us who talked. Antonio was silent. In other words, it became a peaceful routine. I went with him to the funeral of Niccolo Scano, the fruit and vegetable seller, who died suddenly of pneumonia. Enzo came home on leave, but wasn't in time to see him alive. We also went together to console Pasquale, Carmen, and their mother Giuseppina, when they learned that their father, the former carpenter who had killed Don Achille, had died in prison from a heart attack. And we were together also when we learned that Don Carlo Resta, the seller of soap and various household items, had been beaten to death in his cellar. We talked about it for a long time. The whole neighborhood talked about it. The talk spread truths and cruel rumors. Someone said that the beating wasn't enough, and they had stuck a file in his nose. Some vagrants were blamed for the crime, people who had stolen the day's cash. But Pasquale, later, told us he had heard rumors that in his view were well-founded. Don Carlo was in debt to the mother of the Saladas, because he had the vice of gambling and went to her so that he could pay his debts. "So what?" asked Ada, who was always skeptical when her fiancé came up with reckless hypotheses.
"So he wouldn't pay what he owed the loan shark, and they had him murdered."
"Come on, you always talk such nonsense." It's likely that Pasquale was exaggerating, but, first of all, no one knew who had killed Don Carlo Resta. And second, it was, precisely, the Saladas who took over the shop, along with its stock, for very little money, even though they left Don Carlo's wife and oldest son there to manage it. "Out of generosity," said Ada.
"Because they're bastards," said Pasquale.
I don't remember if Antonio made comments on that episode. He was crushed by his illness, which Pasquale's speeches in some way made more acute. It seemed to him that the dysfunction of his body was spreading to the whole neighborhood and was manifested in the bad things that happened. The worst thing for us happened on a warm Sunday in the spring, when Pasquale and Ada and he and I were waiting in the courtyard for Carmela, who had gone up to get a pullover. 5 minutes passed. Carmen looked out the window, shouted to her brother, "Pasqua, I can't find Mama. The door of the bathroom is locked from the inside. but she doesn't answer.
Pasquale took the stairs two at a time and we followed. We found Carmela standing anxiously in front of the bathroom door, and Pasquale knocked, politely, again and again, but no one answered. Antonio then said to his friend, indicating the door, "Don't worry, I'll put it back in place." And grabbing the handle, he practically tore it off. The door opened. Giuseppina Peluso had been a radiant woman, energetic, hard-working, kindly, capable of confronting all adversities. She had continued without fail to occupy herself with her imprisoned husband, whose arrest, I remembered, she had opposed with all her strength when he was accused of killing Don Achille Caracci. She had thoughtfully accepted Stefano's invitation to spend New Year's Eve together 4 years earlier, pleased with that reconciliation between the families. And she had been happy when her daughter found work, thanks to Lila, in the grocery in the new neighborhood. But now, with her husband dead, evidently she was worn out. She had become, in a short time, a tiny woman, skin and bone, without her old vigor. She had unfastened the lamp in the bathroom, a metal plate hanging on a chain, and had attached a clothesline to the hook set in the ceiling. Then she had hanged herself by the neck. Antonio saw her first and burst into tears. It was easier to calm Giuseppina's children, Carmen and Pasquale, than him. He repeated to me, horrified, "Did you see that her feet were bare, and that the nails were long, and that on one foot there was fresh red nail polish, and not on the other?" I hadn't noticed, but he had. He had returned from military service more convinced than before, in spite of his nervous breakdown, that his job was to be the man in every situation, the one who hurls himself into danger fearlessly and resolves every problem. But he was fragile. For weeks after that episode, he saw Giuseppina in every dark corner of the house, and he got worse. So I neglected some of my obligations to help him calm down. He was the only person in the neighborhood I saw more or less regularly until I took my graduation exams. I had just a glimpse of Lila next to her husband at Giuseppina's funeral while she hugged Carmen, who was sobbing. She and Stefano had sent a large wreath on whose violet ribbon the condolences of the Caracci spouses could be read. 80. It wasn't because of the exams that I stopped seeing Antonio. The two things happened to coincide, because just then he came to see me, rather relieved, to tell me that he had accepted a job from the Salata brothers. I didn't like it. It seemed to me another sign of his illness. He hated the Salatas. He had scuffled with them as a boy to defend his sister. He, Pasquale, and Enzo had beaten up Marcello and Michele and destroyed their car. But the main thing was that he had left me because I went to ask Marcello for his help in getting Antonio out of military service. Why then had he succumbed like that? He gave me confused explanations. He said that in the army he had learned that if you are a simple soldier, you owe obedience to anyone who wears stripes. He said that order is better than disorder. He said he had learned how you come up behind a man and kill him before he has even heard you arrive. I understood that the illness had something to do with it, but that the real problem was poverty. He had presented himself at the bar to ask for work, and Marcello had treated him a little roughly, but then had offered him a fixed amount each month, he put it like that, without, however, a precise duty. Only to be available. Available? Yes. Available for what?
I don't know.
Forget it, Anto.
He didn't.
And because of that job, he ended up quarreling with both Pasquale and Enzo, who had returned from military service more taciturn than before, more inflexible. Illness or not, neither of them could forgive Antonio for that decision. Pasquale, although he was engaged to Ada, went so far as to threaten him. He said that, brother-in-law or not, he didn't want to see him anymore. I quickly got away from these problems and concentrated on my graduation exam. While I studied day and night, sometimes overwhelmed by the heat, I thought again about the previous summer, before Pinuccia left, when Lila, Nino, and I were a happy trio. Or, at least, so it seemed to me. But I repressed every image, and even the faintest echo of a word. I allowed no distractions. The exam was a crucial moment of my life. In a couple of hours, I wrote an essay on the role of nature in the poetry of Giacomo Leopardi, putting in, along with lines I knew by heart, finely written reworkings from the textbook of Italian literary history. But, most important, I handed in my Latin and Greek tests when my schoolmates, including Alfonso, had barely started on it. This attracted the attention of the examiners, in particular of an old, extremely thin teacher with a pink suit and freshly coiffed pale blue hair, who kept smiling at me. But the real turning point took place during the oral exams. I was praised by all the professors, but in particular I gained the approval of the examiner with the blue hair. She had been struck by my essay not only because of what I said, but because of how I said it. "You write very well," she said, with an accent I didn't recognize, but anyway far from Neapolitan. "Thank you. Do you really think that nothing is fated to last? Not even poetry?" "That's what Leopardi thinks."
"You're sure?"
"Yes."
"And what do you think?"
"I think that beauty is a sham."
"Like the Leopardian garden?"
I didn't know anything about Leopardian gardens, but I answered, "Yes, like the sea on a calm day, or like a sunset, or like the sky at night. It's like face powder patted on over the horror. If you take it away, we are left alone with our fear." The sentences came easily. I uttered them with an inspired cadence. And besides, I wasn't improvising. It was an adaptation of what I had written in the essay.
"What faculty do you intend to choose?"
I didn't know much about faculties. That meaning of the term was barely familiar to me. I was evasive.
"I'll sit the civil service exam."
"You won't go to the university?"
My cheeks burned, as if I were unable to hide a sin.
"No."
"You need to work?"
"Yes."
I was dismissed. I returned to Alfonso and the others.
But a little later, the professor came up to me in the hallway and talked for a long time about a kind of college in Pisa, where, if you passed an exam like the one I had already done, you studied free.
"If you come back here in a couple of days, I'll give you all the necessary information."
I listened, but the way you do when someone is talking to you about something that will never really concern you. And when, 2 days later, I went back to school, only out of fear that the professor would be offended and give me a low grade, I was struck by the very precise information that she had transcribed for me on a sheet of foolscap. I never met her again. I don't even know her name. And yet I owe her a great deal. Continuing to address me formally, she unaffectedly gave me a dignified farewell embrace. The exams were over. I passed with an A average. Alfonso also did well, with a B average. Before leaving forever, with no regrets, the run-down gray building whose only merit in my eyes was that Nino too had been there, I caught sight of Professor Galliani and went to say goodbye. She congratulated me on my results, but without enthusiasm. She didn't offer me books for the summer. She didn't ask what I would do now that I had my high school diploma. Her distant tone upset me. I thought that things between us had been settled. What was the trouble? Once Nino had left her daughter and had fallen out of touch, was I to be associated with him forever? The same clay? Insubstantial? Unserious? Unreliable? I was used to being liked by everyone, to wrapping that liking around me like shining armor. I was disappointed, and I think that her indifference had an important role in the decision I then made. Without talking about it to anyone, who could I ask advice from anyway if not Professor Galliani, I applied for admission to the Pisa Normale. I immediately started doing everything I possibly could to earn money. Since the upper-class families whose children I had given lessons to all year were happy with me, and my reputation as a good teacher had spread, I was able to fill the August days with new students who had to retake, in September, their exams in Latin, Greek, history, philosophy, and even mathematics. At the end of the month, I found myself rich. I had amassed 70,000 lire. I gave 50 to my mother, who reacted with a violent gesture. She almost tore the money from my hand and stuffed it in her bra, as if we were not in the kitchen of our house, but on the street, and she was afraid of being robbed. I didn't tell her that I had kept 20,000 lire for myself. Not until the day before my departure did I tell my family that I was going to Pisa to take exams. If they accept me, I announced, I'll go there to study, and I won't have to spend a lira for anything. I spoke with great decisiveness, in Italian, as if it were not a subject that could be reduced to dialect, as if my father, my mother, my siblings, shouldn't and couldn't understand what I was about to do. In fact, they confined themselves to listening uneasily. It seemed to me that in their eyes, I was no longer me, but a stranger who had come to visit at an inconvenient time. Finally, my father said, "Do what you have to do, but be careful. We can't help you." And he went to bed. My little sister asked if she could come with me. My mother, instead, said nothing. But before she vanished, she left 5,000 lire on the table for me. I stared at it for a long time, without touching it. Then, overcoming my scruples about how I wasted money to satisfy my whims, I thought, "It's my money." And I took it. For the first time, I left Naples, left Campania. I discovered that I was afraid of everything, afraid of taking the wrong train, afraid of having to pee and not knowing where to do it, afraid that it would be night and I wouldn't be able to orient myself in an unfamiliar city, afraid of being robbed. I put all my money in my bra, as my mother did, and spent hours in a state of wary anxiety that coexisted seamlessly with a growing sense of liberation. Everything went well, except the exam, it seemed. The professor with the blue hair hadn't told me that it would be much more difficult than the graduation exam. The Latin especially seemed complex. But really, that was only the beginning. Every test was the occasion for an extremely painstaking investigation of my skills. I held forth. I stammered. I often pretended to have the answer on the tip of my tongue. The professor of Italian treated me as if even the sound of my voice irritated him. "You, miss, you do not make a logical argument when you write,
but flit from one thing to another. I see, miss, that you launch recklessly into subjects in which you are completely ignorant of the issues of critical method.